explore new avenues. Khadija Sepanji, head of women's football in the Iran Football Federation, suggested Mozaffar lead the new national football team at the West Asian Football Games. She took on the feat without a single football player at first. Finally, when it came to choosing between football and futsal, well, Iran was a pioneer in the latter in Asia thanks to her kind. And that's what she went with, futsal, especially as Iran was lagging behind in football next to its Asian rivals.
Well, we've always faced shortcomings when it comes to sports. This has been the case for a long time. Due to the gender-based discrimination that has existed since the old days, we've always had a shortage of facilities and specialized people. Thankfully, it's much better compared to what it used to be. Thank God, as time passed by, the girls were able to show their real potential and break the glass ceiling, prompting people involved in sports to invest in them.
Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
The effort and triumph was a collective effort, really, arising mostly simply from a love of sport on the part of women. Sport-crazy students of the all-girls Al-Zahra University in Tehran pushed their university administrators into licensing a groundbreaking unofficial futsal tournament. This attracted 9 other college teams. It was as early as 1993. 4 years later, as if by a cultural revolution of another kind, the Physical Education Organization had formed a futsal committee.
Thankfully, over the past 2 to 3 years, things have grown a lot better for women, especially when it comes to public sports and those women like to compete in. It's become better both in terms of organization by the federations and providing financial support. It's become a lot better in the past 2 to 3 years, and I hope things will get even better in the coming years. I believe cyberspace has made an impact on women's willingness to exercise. It's like we've had a sudden surge in demand. When the demand increases, the gaps in our facilities are made known. This will promote the authorities to address the issues.
Let's also take a look at where an international interest in Iranian sports lies. As celebrities comment or even join the audience at tournaments, that's in the news section. Here's how it looks on the page. Tehran Times reads, WSF President Woolridge lauds Iranian women. Zina Woolridge, the president of the World Squash Federation, WSF, lauded the Iranian sportswomen. Squash has developed in Iran in recent years. The world is changing, and there's a lot we can do to influence that. And there are nations who are driving change in and through squash, where we may not have expected, Woolridge said. Nations such as Iran are doing some fabulous work to grow the sport amongst women and girls, she added. The World Squash Federation is very much influenced by the actions taken in Iran by the Squash Federation of the country, which has been able to develop squash, especially the expansion of relations outside Iran, and also empowerment of Iranian women and girls, Woolridge said. Now, volleyball has always been a favorite with girls' schools here, and Tasnim News tells of a visit to its federation by a personality about town. Australian ambassador pays visit to Iran Volleyball Federation. Australia's ambassador to Iran, Lyndall Sachs, accompanied by Dennis Khani, her deputy head of mission in Tehran, met with the Islamic Republic of Iran Volleyball Federation, IRIVF, president Mohammad Reza Davarzani at the federation headquarters. Also in attendance were Shahram Azimi, head of international relations at the Ministry of Sports and Youth, and Vahid Moradi, a senior advisor to the IRIVF president. During Sachs' visit, Davarzani highlighted the growth and sustainable development of volleyball in Iran and explained the facilities of Iranian volleyball in the men and women's sections and the international activities of Iranian volleyball in recent years. Sachs, along with the IRIVF officials, visited the Women's Volleyball Academy at the Azadi Sports Complex in Tehran and expressed her surprise and satisfaction with the extensive facilities provided by the federation in the field of women's volleyball. The Guardian talks of International Women's Day. Iran's Rakhshani nominated for 2022 International Women's Day Awards. Fatema Rakhshani of Iran was nominated for leadership category of the 2022 International Women's Day recognition. Rakhshani, current chairperson of the Asian Paralympic Committee's Women in Sport Committee, has a substantial influence on women in parasport in Iran. A two-term vice president of NPC Iran, she increased the number of females in the Iranian delegation at the Paralympic Games from less than 5% at the London 2012 to 17% at the Rio 2016. Through her athleticism as a para swimmer, Rakhshani also works to involve communities in physical activity. That'll be it for the news section, but do stay tuned. Ancient Iran had a tradition of women participating, even in combat and warfare. Also, today, minus the few on an international level, an innumerable number of sports are at the disposal of women. Amateur recreation ranges from water sports in our southern waters mostly to skiing and volleyball. Some get to turn their love into a profession depending on their ability and how feasible their choice sport is for overseas competition.
I believe that the Ministry of Sports allocates more budgets to well-established sports like Taekwondo and Karate, whose federations in Iran are some 50 years old. But the Sports Federation and the Martial Arts Association might not allocate enough funds to more than 50 different sub-styles. They might only focus on Muay Thai or kickboxing, or they would launch competition among all the sports and choose 4 to 5 people and bring them to the national team, which has been happening for only a couple of years.
In September 2021, Elnaz Rekabi made a name in the news as Iran's first woman to win a medal at the International Federation of Sport Climbing, IFSC, World Championships. Nicknamed Spider Woman, she won the bronze in Russia after Slovenia's silver medalist Mia Krampel and Austria's Jessica Pils, who got the gold medal. Now, mentioning old Iran brings me to a form of recreation and sport you could call the bodybuilding of olden days, but it was so much more. It prepared men for battle. Known as Zurkhane, Pahlavani, or heroic sports, it's a combination of bodybuilding and martial arts, a very Iranian understanding of the use of sports. Another world-class sport, traditional sport in Iran, is wrestling, also included in Zurkhane sports, if football mania allows it to survive. In Zurkhanes, or powerhouses, an interesting device is the mil, a conical wooden club. In spinning, while swinging round the mil, strongmen are practicing the battle move Death Cycle. How it works is when in war soldiers were outnumbered, they'd spin, weapon or weapons in hand, like a death machine, just chopping down any enemy soldier nearing them. Now, these manly Zurkhane sports have their fans among women, and I don't mean fans of the champions, no. Over recent years, a small but increasing number of women in this country have been claiming or reclaiming male-dominated sports. Rayeh Mozaffarian is an activist who is herself an athlete and practices Pahlavani and Zurkhaneh sport, the 2,000-year-old Iranian sport originally practiced by warriors, which is today practiced in remembrance of Ali, the first imam or leader of Shia Muslims. Commonly referred to simply as Zurkhaneh, it is a combination of mixed martial arts, wrestling, and calisthenics. Undeterred by the ban on women in this field, unlike universal martial arts such as taekwondo or karate, Mozaffarian and another woman, Esbati, continue to practice the sport at a local park. Perhaps practicing in the park will soon turn it into another community sport for women too. And why not? Because we've been Muslim for the past 1,400 years? Well, Islamic sports scientists emphasize that health and fitness are important for men and women alike and should be sustained by sporting activities. Their claim is supported by hadith or sayings of the Prophet Muhammad, who recommended his followers train their children in running, riding, swimming, and archery, not specifying gender. That'll be it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Perhaps we'll do a little something again on sport with the next women's tournament coming up. Otherwise, there'll still be much to say on our usual politics. So do join us again at the same times next week and each week after. Bye for now.
The Iranian New Year, Nowruz, is almost here.
Join IRIB English Radio on Sunday afternoon, 20th of March at 1500 hours GMT as we chime in the new year at 1533 GMT.
We celebrate Nowruz live on air on Sunday afternoon, March 20th, 2022, around the traditional half-seen table.
We wish you a wonderful and prosperous Nowruz.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoint on the occasion of Imam Mahdi's birth anniversary.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. First of all, I would like to congratulate you, dear brothers and sisters, on the auspicious Eid, which is the full of hope and promise for all faithful people. I also congratulate all those who believe in the leadership of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, household, and all those who fight oppression, as well as all vigilant, knowledgeable, and free-seeking people. The 15th of Sha'ban is a day that is full of promise. The promise is neither peculiar to Shia Muslim nor even the entire Islamic Ummah. To the best of my knowledge, the promise of a bright future for humanity and the arrival of a promised savior for promoting justice are universal beliefs that are shared by almost all divine religions across the world. Apart from Islam, Christianity and Judaism, even Hindu faiths such as Buddhism and other religions that most people have not even heard about have informed their fellows of such future in their teachings. In fact, this has provided man with kind of hope throughout history. It is a response to human need for this hope. Divine religions, which often have divine and celestial roots, did not intend to give people false hopes. They all express a reality. There is a reality in the creation of man in the long history of humanity. And that reality is that one day the battle between good and evil is going to result in the defeat of evil and the victory of good.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
After this stage, man's true and pleasant life is going to begin, in which struggle will no longer imply fighting, rather people will struggle for equality in doing righteous deeds. This is a fact that is shared by all religions. One outstanding characteristic of our Shia beliefs is that this denomination has transformed this aspiration and this abstract concept into a concrete reality. In fact, when the Shia are waiting for the arrival of the promised savior, Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salamullah, are not lost in their fantasies, they are searching for a reality. He's alive and living amongst the people. He sees people, he can feel their suffering. Those who are lucky enough have the capacity sometimes to meet him without recognizing him. He's alive, he lives amongst us. He has a name. This is what characterizes our Shia beliefs. And the followers of other faiths who do not believe in this reality have never been able to provide any logical reasons to reject this belief. There are several obvious and strong reasons also accepted by Sunni Muslims, which are a testimony to that existence of this exalted servant of Allah. All those reasons provide evidence that Imam al-Mahdi, may our souls be sacrificed for his sake, is living amongst us. And we are all aware of this characteristics. This is what has been cited in many non-Shia sources as well.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all.
What you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Come here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people. Women in the U.S.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. And in this episode, we're going to speak about women in America. What are the problems women face in the workplace and society? What has been done to address inequality and discrimination towards women? Are women safe? What are the issues of single mothers? And what are some issues African-American women face in society as well? Today, we are pleased to have our two special guests on our show, Oniusonwa Chatoyor, editor at Hood Communist and organizer with the All African People's Revolutionary Party, and Yemi Belechu, who is director of operations for People's Programs based in Oakland, California.
Women in different social movements have been fighting for their rights in the United States for a very long time. Depending on the movement that spearheaded the fight for women's rights, the success might have played in the hands of the corporate elites of the American capitalistic society.
So this is one of the reasons that despite long, hard struggle of American women today, many problems still persist. Violence against women is rampant and most see no clear solutions. So what are some of the problems women in America are facing today, ma'am?
A culture of abuse. We experience it, objectification, exploitation, starting from childhood. It continues even into the domestic realm. There's a very, very high incidence of domestic violence, particularly within poor and working class communities in the United States. And then like the places that we can turn to for so-called justice, like the police, oftentimes have the same problem. Police have extremely high incidence of domestic violence within police agencies. They also have patriarchal attitudes that make them disbelieve women who are victims. So basically it's like a culture of impunity while domestic violence and sexual abuse are happening.
Now, according to the RAINN Institute statistics, that's RAINN if you want to check it, every 68 seconds an American is sexually assaulted. Also, one in five or 20% of women in America have been victims of complete or attempted rape. These are just numbers. No number, though, can show the true effects of violence towards women, a third of which were below 18 years of age at the time of assault. American society is truly not a safe place for women and children who are the more vulnerable. So why is sexual assault so prevalent in America today?
Yeah, I think that you see, what you said is really right. And I think exploitation, so interpersonal exploitation, right, is kind of base, which is what sexual assault is, right? It's interpersonal levels of exploitation. And that's best based in, you know, patriarchy, which is another aspect of capitalist, you know, a capitalist government, a capitalist economic system, which continues to divide us, right, not only by class, but also by gender and by race. And I think additionally, you know, a lot of the statistics around sexual assault have to do with lack of trust in the police state, right, and traditional forms of seeking justice. And so, you know, out in the United States, you know, there's around 2 out of 3 sexual assaults that women experience go unreported. And I think a lot of that has to do, right, not only with objectification, but also just like no means of accountability that actually changes the material impact of the women, right? So they experience sexual assault, but you know, what is going to happen if they try to seek justice for it? They're either going to be ignored or themselves will be criminalized further that by the system. I think, you know, another aspect of you said with the objectification of women, I think, yes, women are treated as object. Black women especially are commodified.
In the American capitalistic society, women are objectified in popular culture, the media, cinema, music, advertisement, billboards, and even at the workplace. While some, especially outside of the country, believe that women in the U.S. are free to dress and act the way they like, they do not see the pure pressure on women to dress sexually in society and sometimes are forced to do so at work.
Definitely think so. Like, even if you look at the media that's popular in the United States, whether it's the music, whether it's the movies, whether it's the television shows, you see like sexualization and objectification of women starting at a very, very young age. We see women being casually denigrated, being called slurs throughout the media and having it played for a joke. So it's absolutely a culture that celebrates denigrating women.
In 2018, a Thomson Reuters survey found the United States among the 10 most dangerous places for women. It ranked third when expert respondents were asked where women most risk sexual violence, harassment, and coercion into sex. This survey reiterated that the U.S. is one of the least safe places in the world for women. Is America really safe for women?
No, we're not. We're not safe in America. We are subject to abuse in all circles of our lives, in our families, in our relationships, at work. Even like just waiting for the bus is a risk for us because, again, the society builds a culture of impunity around denigration of women, around patriarchy, around our objectification. And so what that means is that you are not safe anywhere. You can't walk alone at night. You have to be careful everywhere you go. You have to like think through possible scenarios where you might get hurt, where you might get victimized, and what you'll do. It's a very exhausting experience, to be honest.
Now, since the economy is the number one goal and objective in American society, and people are required to compete to get ahead in life, many women have also come to believe that if they are raising children or making a home, they are worthless, and in order to succeed, they need to abide by cultural norms which have been set out for them, essentially turning them into commodities.
Another aspect of you said with the objectification of women, I think, yes, women are treated as object. Black women especially are commodified in a lot of different ways. I think one way is just, you know, sexually, definitely through popular culture, right? Through media, it's always this hypersexualization. But I think that ties back to the understanding of, you know, how we are seen in this system. And it's seen as, you know, our value is tied to sexual, our value is tied to unpaid labor, you know, homework, things like taking care of your family, taking care of these different things. And there's just a lack of valuing Black women in a capitalist system, are undervaluing them in order to continue to exploit them unjustly. And I think it goes hand in hand. Sexual assault and harassment goes hand in hand with exploitation. But it's acted out in that more interpersonal level.
In the economic and labor sector, although an increasing number of women are either the sole breadwinner for their family or share the role with their partners, women in the United States are paid only 77 cents for every dollar a man makes. The pay gap is even larger for African American women, where on average they get paid 64 cents for every dollar a white man makes for the same job.
I think, one, since the beginning of this, you know, of understanding what capitalism is, the type of women, the type of work that Black women do, right, caregiver, keeping up the home, right, family, logistical work, is seen as less valuable, right? And especially Black women. And then there's an additional layer there. And I think really the foundation is that this capitalist system, these jobs are created to be exploited. And since the white supremacist capitalist system is built by white people, ultimately you see these billionaires, you see these Jeff Bezoses, the Amazons, who are ultimately going to create a system that benefits them the most. Therefore, women being paid less is just another form of exploitation to increase profit for those people. And I think Black women and African women experience that double exploitation, which is they are Black, right? Which is another method of exploitation under capitalism, and they are women. Therefore, they're paid less, they are valued less than their white counterparts, even though they're doing the same exact type of work, even though they're continuing to, you know, either they're working in those same jobs, which is, you know, could be any job and they're getting paid less, or they are working in, you know, blue collar jobs and continuing to be exploited at really higher rates than anyone else. So I think it has to do with the way the system values human beings as a whole, and then how the way the system of capitalism specifically exploits Black women, you know, in these systems and devalues their work and their labor.
My name is Sophia Cotton.
Mommy.
I'm a single mom. Mm. I make $230 to $240 every 2 weeks. I've been working there for almost a year. days since I started working here. They have a slow week, you go home every day. I came into work one morning, I had to be there at 7. And once the general manager came in, she came in like 7:30, 8 o'clock, and she was like, okay, well, Sophia, you can clock out. And I'm like, well, I just got here. She's like, oh, well, we don't need you, labor's high. You can go ahead and clock out. It's not really matter to them if we making our hours and getting paid. I got $261 in food stamps last month.
After years of struggle, the Equal Pay Act was passed in 1963 so that men and women be paid the same when they're doing the same job at the same place. The jobs need not to be identical, but similar. Even though it has been years since this law was passed in the Kennedy administration, women still get paid substantially less than men, and they often fill less paying jobs. This is especially the case for African American and Latin American women. How can these conditions be improved?
Part of the reason is the lack of an organized workers' movement in the United States. Even if you are hired at a job, you're discouraged from organizing with your coworkers, from communicating about salaries and pay, which oftentimes has the impact of hiding deep inequalities for a long, long time. And so what women need to do is join efforts to unionize and build collective power among workers, because that's how we're going to force the improvement of our conditions.
Women in America are also allowed and take jobs which were once considered as a job solely for men and still are in many countries around the globe. American women sign up for the U.S. military and take different roles in all U.S. Armed Forces divisions. Now, statistics published by the New York Times show thousands of service women are sexually assaulted in the military every year, and most cases are swept under the rug by the commanding officers. The newspaper reported last year that there is an epidemic of sexual assaults in the U.S. military.
Well, the military is a really clear example of what I've been trying to talk about, like this culture of impunity in the United States. Like, women are told that we are equal to men in that particular context, but when women enlist in the U.S. military, they oftentimes face an extremely high rate of sexual abuse, again happening within a culture of impunity. The woman is more likely to be punished or dismissed in a context where she is abused sexually within the military than the perpetrator himself. It's the same thing in so many other workplaces, whether it's like migrant farm work, whether it's service industry jobs, whether it's administrative jobs. Like, this is what women are facing across industries. And at the same time, we have that lie of representation that says women should aspire to be like people like Hillary Clinton or Kamala Harris or any number of women who occupy positions within a system that's exploiting all of us.
The COVID-19 pandemic has also caused major issues for women in the country. Interestingly, polls in the United States have shown that mothers working from home during the pandemic have reported higher rates of anxiety, depression, and loneliness than fathers. This displays how the role of mothers has drastically changed throughout the years in a capitalistic society. Last year, 3 million women dropped out of the workforce, and 1.6 million of them have still not returned.
Part of the organizing work that I do with People's Programs is direct service work with our Hot Meals program, which means we're giving hot meals out to homeless people and unhoused people here in Oakland, California. And, you know, we see Black women on the street every day, and they have no access to water, food, shelter, and health care. And I think there's a common misconception that because we live in the richest country of the world, the United States, that we have access to these human rights. But I see every single day, Black women and Black people suffering under capitalism, meaning they don't have their basic needs met. And I think that this country has a really good way of masking that by showing certain Black people in positions of power, but the masses of Black people, the Black women in that masses are living on the street, are experiencing extreme poverty. You know, you can go from the folks who are homeless to folks in our grocery program that we feed and deliver free groceries to. You know, single mothers in those programs are working 70 hours a week trying to take care of their children and their families, and being exploited not only through their labor, but also, you know, through the family structure of not being able to sustain and take care of their communities. I think you touched on this. I touched on this earlier, but, you know, there's a lot of medical apartheid that is happening in this country, especially to Black women who are dying at birth, who are giving birth, who are experiencing higher rates of high blood pressure, higher rates of diabetes, higher rates of other health issues that are preventable, right? But without access to the healthcare system or adequate access to the healthcare system, they're continuing to suffer under these different situations. And so I think being poor and underprivileged in the United States is basically being criminalized and neglected and being, you know, actively exploited at every point in your life here. So I think for women, they fall under it, especially for Black women. They're continuing to be exploited, especially poor Black women here in the United States.
Western society's dominant view on women and culture as a whole and norms of a capitalistic system are mostly to blame for the unfortunate and sad situation of women in America. Modern ignorance, which is spread in all aspects of Western life, objectifies women and makes women a commodity for the enjoyment of men, either as sexual objects or as low-income workers, making the rich richer. And now it's that time, everyone, we check in with Abbas Montarim to get his take on the story.
My people, and welcome back to Power to the People. Today on the show, we're going to discuss some of the revolutionary history of Black students and how Black students have been essential in the Black radical tradition. So let's get into it, you feel me? Thank y'all for rocking with me. So we must understand that Black students have been an integral part of movements seeking to end Euro-American colonial domination. In the Civil Rights Movement, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, often referred to as SNCC, was formed to organize the Black community in the racist Jim Crow South. SNCC organized student-led sit-ins at segregated lunch counters, as well as boycotts, protests, and voter registration to combat Jim Crow-era voter disenfranchisement. They also organized what they called Freedom Summers, in which hundreds of students, volunteers, went into Mississippi for mass voter drives, as well as establishing freedom schools for Black youth. This organizing led to racist violence from the state and vigilantes. SNCC members were regularly harassed, beaten, murdered, and brutalized by law enforcement and the Ku Klux Klan. And we know that members of the KKK were also cops. The violence of white supremacy, as well as the lack of change through the so-called bourgeoisie democratic electoral process, it led to some of SNCC's members radicalizing and beginning to reject the nonviolent stance of the civil rights movement. One of these members was none other than Stokely Carmichael, who was later known as Kwame Ture. Kwame Ture, he popularized the phrase Black Power and advocated for the complete independence of our people, as well as picking up arms to defend ourselves from colonial violence, as we know it is our human right to do so. A'Trap Brown, who later changed his name to Jamil Al-Amin, he then became the leader of SNCC. He took the N for Nonviolence out of SNCC and replaced it with the N for National. He also made a public alliance with the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California, and ended up joining the Black Panther Party as well. We must understand that this was a natural evolution for Black student organizing, and it became more militant due to the conditions of this racist, white supremacist violence that Black students was facing. Black students began arming themselves to defend themselves from white terrorism. One example of this was the Black Panther Party, as the party evolved out of the Black student movement as well. Both Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, who co-founded the Black Panther Party, they were both students when they met at Merritt Junior College in North Oakland, California. While they were students, they co-founded the Seoul Students Advisory Committee, which is the predecessor of the Black Student Union. And today, there's BSUs at colleges and high schools throughout the whole country. The Oakland Police Department, they was regularly harassing, brutalizing, and murdering Black people. And Huey and Bobby, they founded the Black Panther Party to combat this violence from the police. The first recruit into the Black Panther Party was 16-year-old Lil Bobby Hutton, and their junior college, Merritt College, has served as a recruiting ground. And one of their first actions was to legally start patrolling the pigs while carrying shotguns. And there were some real boys. The Black Panther Party is also responsible for helping create Black Studies. As point 5 of the 10-point program said, they wanted a true education for their people. And at Merritt College, Black Studies was created due to Black student organizing. And the first chair of the department was Melvin Newton, who was a member of the Black Panther Party and Huey Newton's brother. And now if we look at Black Studies today, there's Black Studies departments and African American Studies departments all throughout the country. And this is because of the Black militant students who paved the way for a whole new department to exist. We must pay a homage to this militant history. And today, Black student movements, they have been fighting to end colonial violence. When I was a student at UC Berkeley, we was organizing and we fought for 10 demands for institutional change. We shut down the campus' biggest restaurant and blocked off the entrance to the school on its biggest recruitment day. All of this organizing led to the creation of the Fannie Lou Hamer Black Resource Center, which is a vital hub for Black students to not only study out of, but to begin to organize. We also forced the University of California school system to divest $30 million from these private prisons. And it isn't just Black students in America who've been fighting back against racism. Black students across the world have been fighting back. In South Africa, students organized the Roads Must Fall campaign, which called for the removal of the statue of the genocidal terrorist named Cecil Rhodes, who was a British colonialist and the so-called prime minister in Cape Colony. South African students also organized a campaign called Fees Must Fall in response to a 10.5% tuition increase. And they were successful as African students organized en masse to stop institutions from increasing tuition. Black students are fundamental for the revolution. As Huey Newton said, the youth inherit the revolution, and Black students must realize and actualize their role in revolution. As Julia Munter King said, students must recognize that their education is not solely for individual gain and pleasure, but rather for the building of minds to serve the movement and the nation. And that nation being the new African nation. This is Power to the People.
Well, that was our program, everyone. Thank you for joining us, and I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and do tune in next week for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
An emergency meeting of NATO defence ministers concluded at the Military Alliance's headquarters in Brussels on Wednesday. They are ready to defend NATO countries in the event Russia expands its mission beyond Ukraine, it's claimed.
There are now hundreds of thousands of forces at heightened alert across the alliance. 100,000 US troops in Europe.
A number of analysts have asked the question, how would Washington feel if Russia positioned 100,000 of its troops, for example, in Mexico? NATO military commanders have been ordered to examine how there can be even further expansion with respect to land, sea, air, cyber, and space capabilities. Jens Stoltenberg has called on NATO members to spend at least 2% of their GDP to grow military forces in response to Russia. Western powers say they won't get directly involved in the Ukraine conflict, but will continue to spend billions on arming Ukraine.
Certainly, we support their ability to defend themselves, and we'll continue to support them going forward.
Unprecedented sanctions against Moscow are starting to hit the EU's economy hard as fuel prices continue to rise and the cost of living generally goes up.
Those are substantial costs that that will have to be paid by the EU collectively, but of course they will hit certain countries harder.
Sanctions are not the answer when it comes to dealing with Russia, according to some experts.
It's not a good situation because it seems to me there are a few mistakes. First of all, such kind of sanctions will be counterproductive generally. It's a way to confrontation.
As the war rages on, Joe Biden and other NATO leaders are due to hold a summit in the Belgian capital on Thursday of next week to consider further options. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A coalition of truckers, farmers, fishermen, and public contractors are blocking refineries as oil prices in France have hit an all-time high, surpassing 2 euros per liter. Added to higher costs at the pump is inflation in prices of food and general goods, as well as looming shortages of vital industrial commodities. France could be headed for a spring of economic discontent amid a presidential election.
Début 2021, le prix du brut était à 51 dollars le baril.
At the start of 2021, the price of gas was at $50 a barrel. First, we had the demand shock caused by the end of coronavirus lockdowns. And then we had a supply shock caused by the failure to meet that demand shock. And now we have the unrest in Ukraine shocking not just the oil market, but seemingly every market. It's been quite a roller coaster.
Last week, the European Union decided against sanctioning Russian fossil fuels, which would have provoked catastrophic economic consequences. However, France has just announced plans to end Russian gas and oil imports in just 5 years. They also announced a package of measures designed to protect French businesses and consumers from rampant inflation, but there's not much they can do about the actual price of oil.
Absolutely not. Non, la dynamique de l'OPEP.
The French government can do absolutely nothing about this situation. It's Russia and Saudi Arabia which have decided the price of oil in recent years, and it's according to their financial and budgetary needs. These two used to care about not making the Americans angry over high prices, but no one really knows how current geopolitical changes will develop. What's certain is that France and Europe have no control over oil prices.
The government recently announced a rebate of 15 cents per liter on all gasoline from April 1st until August 1st, but they didn't do one thing in their power: reduce gasoline taxes.
In France, two-thirds of the price of gas comes from taxes. Gas taxes are regressive and not progressive because they hurt the lower classes more than the rich. In 2018, the Yellow Vest movement was sparked by an increase in gas taxes.
Gas prices back then were just €1.50 per liter, illustrating how precarious the situation is for the average Frenchman and perhaps for politicians facing re-election. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
As the cost of living in the EU goes through the roof, union members held a demonstration outside a meeting of EU finance ministers in Brussels on Tuesday. They want the bloc's leaders to provide more support for EU citizens who are being hit hard by the financial ramifications resulting from the conflict in Ukraine.
And it's also why we need to say that we need to stop this war, because it's affecting our workers, and our workers have already been affected with prices because of the COVID situation, and now we have to say stop this war and stop Putin in Ukraine.
Finance ministers have signed off on the fourth package of sanctions against Russia. 600 individuals have been targeted, and Russian exports too. However, there is a very negative boomerang effect for the EU itself.
We'll see overall higher inflation, pressure on energy and food prices, and market volatility. Rising energy and commodity prices, disruptions of supply chains, it all will have negative knock-off effect on consumer prices and on investment.
Russia, which is now the most sanctioned country in the world, has been removed from the so-called Most Favoured Nation clause relating to the World Trade Organization.
This major decision entitles the EU to increase customs duties at any moment on Russian products. As regards sanctions, all options remain on the table.
Finance ministers say €200 billion worth of loans are available to EU nations most impacted by the Ukrainian refugee crisis.
Critics say if Western leaders had have shown more skill and compromise when listening to Russia's security concerns, the misery now being piled on Ukrainian citizens and the financial hardship being placed on EU citizens could have been avoided. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
As the Ukraine exodus intensifies, Poland's major cities are starting to show signs of strain under the pressure, with local authorities warning that they simply can't cope with more arrivals.
This is just one of the many border crossings between Poland and Ukraine. Just behind me, a few meters, is Ukraine. Now, all day long, we've been witnessing coaches, vans, cars going backwards and forwards, supplies and aid going in, people and refugees coming out.
Whilst here, we managed to speak with Max, a Ukrainian from the Czech Republic. He's been waiting hours for his mother-in-law, who has fled from Kyiv. Speaking to Press TV, he informed us about his anger at the lack of help he sees on the ground from the rest of Europe.
I have no words how to describe overall situation. It's horrible. When people just crossing by in winter with kids, I have no words how to describe this situation. Frankly, there is support from Europe, but perhaps not quite enough.
Then suddenly, a call came through. Alex's mother-in-law had finally arrived.
I'm glad that we have finally succeeded.
Reunited again, finally. They now can head off to safety. But many more refugees aren't so lucky and remain stranded without key essentials. With reports of at least two Ukrainians crossing the Polish border every 3 seconds, how long can Poland maintain this huge humanitarian effort? Robert Carter, Dorohusk.
Iran expects a good agreement to be reached in the near future in its talks on the revival of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known as the JCPOA. This was made by Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian at a press conference following talks with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Moscow. Amir Abdollahian said the delay in the negotiations could lead to the creation of good ground for resolving the remaining issues. He also said that Russia has not created any obstacles in the negotiations on the JCPOA revival, and that the Vienna talks are in no way connected with the conflict in Ukraine.
Russia does not create any obstacles to reaching agreements. There is no connection between the developments in Ukraine and the Vienna talks. And until the end of the negotiations and the achievement of a good, powerful and lasting agreement, Russia will be close to Iran and will support Iran to achieve this agreement.
Meanwhile, Sergei Lavrov said his country has received written guarantees from the United States that Western sanctions on Russia over Ukraine will not affect cooperation with Iran within the framework of the JCPOA.
We received written guarantees. They are included in the text of the agreement itself on the resumption of the JCPOA on the Iranian nuclear program. These texts provide reliable protection for all the projects and areas of activity envisaged by the JCPOA, including the direct involvement of our companies, specialists, including their cooperation on such a flagship project of our cooperation as the Bushehr nuclear power plant, in the context of all existing plans in this regard.
Lavrov also rejected claims that Russia has created an obstacle to negotiations in the Austrian capital, backing the quick revival of the 2015 agreement.
There have been no exorbitant demands from our side, and there are none. All our rights within the framework of cooperation with Iran on the projects that the JCPOA provides for are reliably protected. I have heard how the Americans are trying to accuse us every day that we are slowing down this agreement. That's a lie. The agreement has not yet been finally approved in some capitals, and the Russian capital, Moscow, is not among them.
Amir Abdollahian and Lavrov also discussed other issues, including the Ukrainian conflict and regional issues such as developments in Afghanistan, Syria and Yemen.
The foreign ministers, along with political and diplomatic issues, discussed economic affairs in order to neutralize the negative impacts and consequences of the U.S. and Western anti-Moscow sanctions through closer cooperation and rapprochement. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The figures were stark, even for those used to dealing with sobering news coming out of Riyadh. The news that the kingdom had executed 81 individuals with little fanfare. The news that British Prime Minister Boris Johnson would then be travelling to Saudi Arabia to meet with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman could not have come at a more politically sensitive time. Various officials, including Health Secretary Sajid Javid, attempted to justify the trip by saying Britain had a very candid and frank relationship with the Persian Gulf state, with Downing Street adding that the UK was still very much against the death penalty. Britain has entered some questionable partnerships in order to secure its own interests in the past and is able to turn a blind eye when it's convenient. But the decision to send the British Prime Minister to Saudi Arabia in the immediate aftermath of a controversial mass execution seems a baffling one. The plan is for the UK PM to convince the Saudis to raise oil and gas production to make up for reduced reliance on Russia. Boris Johnson has a cost of living crisis on his hands, the biggest squeeze on incomes in over three decades. The UK crisis has caused the UK government to scramble for energy solutions, but is further reliance on Riyadh sensible? Critics argue a resounding no. Amina Taylor, London.
The United Nations WFP has expressed concern about the situation of children in Afghanistan, announcing that acute malnutrition rates are high in 28 out of 34 provinces of the country. The UN body says 3.5 million Afghan children currently need nutrition treatment. The head of Indira Gandhi Children's Hospital believes this situation is due to cuts in global aid and mass poverty triggered by U.S. sanctions.